Hello, I'm Marcus Louth, and welcome to the latest edition of the UFO Insight podcast, where we examine all things UFOs and aliens, conspiracies and mysteries, and all aspects of the paranormal. Okay, today we will examine some of the apparent UFO crashes that are perhaps a little less well known than the events that unfolded in Roswell in the summer of 1947. In fact, as we will see, several of these apparent UFO crashes are claimed to have taken place several years before the Roswell crash, suggesting that there was a UFO present here on Earth before the wider public became aware of it. What's more, there are many more of these alleged lesser-known UFO crashes than we might think, and while we can't cover all of them here, we will look at as many as we possibly can. And remember, you can read more about these type of UFO encounters at ufoinsight.com. Okay, so we're not going to examine the alleged Roswell crash here, as it is so well known, even outside of UFO circles. We will start, though, with an alleged crash that is said to have occurred 6 years previously in the spring of 1941, just outside of Cape Girardeau in Missouri, when a strange craft streamed out of the sky and crashed into the rocky terrain, seemingly resulting in the deaths of all those on board. Although there had been rumours of the incident for several years, it wasn't until the late 1970s when a lady named Charlotte Mann began to speak publicly of the night her grandfather received a strange phone call in response to the apparent crash. It would make UFO researchers and enthusiasts reassess the account, and in some cases, begin to dig deeper. According to Mann, after leaving the house late that evening, her grandfather returned home with a strange tale to rival the strangest of strangest tales. Before he began, he stated clearly and precisely he could never repeat what he was about to tell them, and he would never speak of it again. Although Charlotte would begin to speak of the encounter in the late 1970s, it wasn't until she gave full interviews with UFO researchers throughout the 90s that the full story began to present itself. The incident unfolded late one April evening, when Charlotte's grandfather, Reverend William Huffman, received a telephone call somewhere between 8 and 9 p.m. After a short exchange, her grandfather donned his coat and offered that a car would be coming to pick him up. Although they only knew the basic information at the time, what they believed was that a local sheriff would be coming to pick up William, and that there had been some kind of aircraft crash. They would later discover they were half correct. According to what Charlotte's grandfather eventually told her upon his return, the scene was a hive of activity. Military personnel and local police mingled with each other. Several men in suits also stood around the scene, mostly observing, but appearing very much in a position of authority. The centerpiece of the whole affair, however, was the remains of a silver metallic disc, almost embedded in the ground, seemingly the result of a crash. Parts of the outer material had broken away in the collision. Over to one side, Huffman could see three small beings, lined up neatly near the wreckage. He walked over to them, looking down tentatively. The strange creatures were clearly humanoid, but also clearly not human. One of them appeared to be alive, but would pass away shortly after the Reverend's arrival. He was asked by one of the plainclothes gentlemen if he would perform blessings over the dead beings. He did as requested, kneeling down in front of them. As he did so, he took in as much of their appearance and attire as he could. Their heads were clearly larger than their frail-looking bodies. Their eyes were equally large. Each was no more than around 4 feet tall and dressed in a tight-fitting one-piece suit that had the appearance of wrinkled-up foil. He would further recall seeing small seats inside the craft, and he could make out lots of gauges and lights. A strange band of material that he didn't know ran throughout the interior of the vehicle. On it was Egyptian-type hieroglyphics. There was also a brilliant shine to the outer layer of the craft, a shine that itself had an otherworldly quality. After that night, the family heard nothing further of the affair. Just what we should make of the claim is open to debate. The account, however, is most certainly intriguing. Several years later, and around 3 months after the apparent Roswell crash in October 1947, another incident unfolded in Paradise Valley, just north of Phoenix, Arizona. According to accounts put forward by UFO researcher Frank Scully in the 1950s and later by Timothy Good in the 1990s, businessman Selman Graves, who was also a private pilot, witnessed the bizarre events while out on a hunting trip with friends. Graves and his friends, including a gentleman named Walt Sailor, whose property they were staying at, were preparing to spend the day hunting in Paradise Valley. However, Sailor would return from checking over the area and stated that the military had restricted the region. What's more, no one was allowed to fire their weapons. Graves, however, wished to explore a region that was home to mine shafts. He assured his host that no weapons would be fired. Ultimately, he and two others went on their way. A short time later, however, after having made their way to the highest point that offered a clear bird's eye view of the entire area, they witnessed something completely otherworldly. After first identifying their friend's property where they were staying, the men's attention settled on a large aluminium dome-shaped object right in the middle of the area they had planned on going hunting. They estimated the object was approximately the size of a house, and there appeared to be intense activity all around it. Graves recalled seeing pitched buildings and tents, as well as lots of personnel moving in, out and around them, clearly carrying out some unknown duties. He would also recall seeing two large military-style flatbed trucks leaving the area, some kind of covered cargo on board. Graves would later theorise it was likely their host, Walt Sailor, who had discovered the downed craft while scouting the area for their hunting trip. Given that he was an ex-military man, Graves suggested it was likely he who alerted the military to his presence, as well as attempting to convince his guests to stay clear of the area. Interestingly, a local legend persisted in the region that a local man had retrieved two alien bodies, and even stored them in his freezer until the military arrived to retrieve them. Could it be that local man was none other than Walt Sailor? Only several months later, another alleged UFO crash unfolded in Aztec, New Mexico. According to the account, which surfaced in a leaked document from the late 1980s, on the evening of 25th of March 1948 in the Aztec desert, a disc-shaped object came blazing out of the sky and crashed into the sandy surface, becoming embedded in the ground. According to reports at the time, several onlookers who witnessed the event were at the scene almost immediately, some of whom would later state to reporters that the craft appeared to be attempting to make an emergency landing. In fact, some of the initial reports of the incident came from nearby oil workers, who according to UFO investigator and author Scott Ramsey, at first thought they'd witnessed a bushfire. Only when they arrived at the location did they realise they were seeing something altogether out of the ordinary. A short time later, however, around noon that day, a military recovery team was seemingly at the location almost immediately, the wreckage said to have been transported, at least initially, to the nearby White Sands Air Force Base. According to some researchers who investigated the case, many of those locals were warned not to speak of what they had seen. The document would continue to detail the craft, stating that it was made from a series of rings that appeared to rotate around a central cabin. It was also noted that the material of the craft was both of a strength they had not previously seen, but also as light as aluminium. Further information would eventually surface from an anonymous former military officer, who disclosed some intriguing details to the researcher Chuck Oldham about a disc that crashed near Farmington in New Mexico a year or two before 1950, which is almost certainly the Aztec incident. The anonymous officer had special military clearance and was able to read restricted files, one of which detailed the crash and recovery in immense detail. According to the file, the craft was around 30 feet across and was the colour of aluminium. What's more, despite its sturdiness, it was so light that only two men were required to move it. There were also several portholes on the craft, although the material in these portholes was unlike any kind of glass previously seen. All of these portholes are intact except for one, which had a small puncture, which was the only defect discovered on the entire craft. The anonymous officer claimed that the team had used diamond drills and all manner of tools on the damaged porthole in order to gain entry, but nothing would break through it. They ultimately did gain entry into the craft, however, it appeared they did so unintentionally when a door suddenly opened where there had previously been no sign of such an opening. According to the report, this door was almost as if the material of the craft had liquefied and then when it closed, solidified once more. Perhaps more amazing than the craft itself was the discovery of the crew, 16 in total, at least according to some reports, 15 of whom were dead. The document stated that these bodies were of human shape but were only 3 feet tall and all were dressed in metallic cloth of some fine texture. What is also of interest is that the report spoken of by the anonymous military officer is that the descriptions of the aliens inside were the same as those mentioned in the memo, that they looked human but were shorter and were dressed in a metallic type suit. It is also worth mentioning an indirect witness who came forward in 1994 and, under the pseudonym of Alfred, spoke to UFO researcher Glenn Campbell. According to Alfred, in the early 1960s he had worked as a technical photographer at the nuclear test site in Nevada, with one of the people he worked specifically closely with being Otto Krauss, a transplanted German scientist who had arrived in the United States as part of Operation Paperclip at the end of the Second World War and was now the project physicist for many of the nuclear test projects. Alfred would continue that he would often find himself playing cards and relaxing with a drink or two with Krauss, and that one evening in particular, the scientist offered that he was aware of at least two UFO crashes in the late 1940s. According to Alfred, this particular night while playing cards, he found himself telling Krauss about a flying saucer he had seen when he was younger in the early 1950s, which then prompted Krauss to reveal what he knew. The one-time Third Reich scientist offered that while he was working at the White Sands base, he discovered that one disc had crashed in Roswell, while the other had come down in Aztec New Mexico. He would continue that both of the downed cosmic vehicles were initially brought to the base, with each placed in separate hangars. Furthermore, although he himself had not seen any alien bodies, he had talked to several people who had, continuing that one of them supposedly lived, and he was eventually moved to what is now better known as Area 51. Of the craft himself, Alfred offered that Krauss informed him he took a long time to get into it and figure out how it worked. He would continue that that was the classified part of the UFO, the mechanism that powered it. This, he said, was more classified than the atomic bomb. What is perhaps further interesting about this is that Krauss claimed that the object worked on magnetic principles. If we return to the anonymous military officer and the information he claimed to have seen in a classified report, the downed UFO appeared to use magnetic or gravitational fields as a form of propulsion. According to the officer, these extraterrestrial vehicles used natural magnetic lines of a planet and a gravity field to move their ships from one place to another. What is interesting about this is Bob Lazar would make remarkably similar claims regarding UFO propulsion. Alfred himself claims he was aware of an apparent UFO crash in Aztec in early 1948. He would inform Timothy Good that he had read a newspaper report in the days that followed and was shocked to see the crash was said to have happened in the same canyon that he and a friend had been horse riding only days previously. As soon as he read the story, he and the same person rode out to the canyon but could find nothing there to indicate a craft had come down. Furthermore, the following day, a story appeared in the same newspaper claiming the UFO crash had simply been a hoax. Incidentally, Alfred would also state following his conversation with Krauss, he had attempted to obtain a copy of the newspaper that the story had appeared in. However, it was the only one to be missing from the public library. You can read more about the alleged alien entity recovered from the Aztec crash at ufoinsight.com, and you can find the link to that article in the description. It isn't just the late 1940s in the United States when we can find reports and claims of crashes of suspected vehicles potentially from other worlds. On the afternoon of May 6, 1978, over the mountain ranges along the border between Bolivia and Argentina, for example, hundreds of Bolivian and Argentinian residents witnessed a bizarre object that was spewing smoke scream out of the sky overhead, eventually crashing into the side of a nearby mountain. From where it impacted, a huge column of smoke was seen rising into the air, and many witnesses later spoke of feeling the ground tremble at the point of impact. Following the apparent crash, the Bolivian Air Force launched several fighter jets to patrol and search the area from above, while the Argentinian military immediately undertook a search of the area on the ground, attempting to locate the actual crash site. Some reports would state that a metallic cylinder-type object was eventually recovered, although these reports appear sketchy at best. A short time after this, apparent NASA officials arrived at the crash site to take charge of the wreckage, with some sources claiming it was then discreetly transferred to the United States. Just what happened to the craft, if indeed it did exist, remains unknown. Just over a decade later, in the early hours of September 2nd, 1990, at around 3 a.m. over Megas Plantas in Greece, six bright lights suddenly appeared in the dark sky. What's more, it was clear from those who saw them that they were approaching the village. It was also clear that while five of them remained in a strict formation, one of the lights was moving extremely erratically. In fact, this sixth light eventually plummeted from the sky and crashed to the ground. One of those who witnessed the incident was a local shepherd, who claimed the object crashed around 1,500 feet from where he was standing. He later told of seeing an immediate flash of fire and flames, which then caught on to the vegetation nearby. As this was happening, he noticed that the five other objects remained hovering overhead, as if observing what was happening below. Suddenly, two of them descended rapidly. Although the shepherd did not see what had happened, at the same time the two objects began their descent, the flames suddenly disappeared. The shepherd witnessed the crash, then seemingly taking it in turns to descend and then climb back into the air once more. It was almost as if he would suggest that they were carrying out some kind of repair to the downed vehicle. Many local residents would venture to the apparent crash site as soon as daylight broke several hours later. However, although they discovered definite scorch marks on the ground, there was no sign whatsoever of a downed vehicle, alien or otherwise. The only physical evidence was the odd piece of metal or wire, all of which were taken by members of the public as mementos of the occasion. Interestingly, the Greek military would arrive in the area several hours later and maintained a presence for several days. According to their official stance, the object that had crashed to the ground had been a Soviet satellite. If that was the case, though, then we have to ask who had managed to retrieve it in the space of only several hours before the local search team arrived. Several years later, at a little after 9 p.m. on September 19, 1995, in Lesotho, an independent nation in Africa that is bordered on all sides by South Africa, was home to one of the strangest UFO crash claims in recent times. The main witness, a South African farmer named Peter Lakasha, recalled hearing a strange sound overhead, as well as noticing at the same time that his cattle had become suddenly anxious. A moment later, the sound of an explosion rang out and shook the region. A small group, led by Lakasha, would head towards the impact site. As they approached it, all could hear an electronic humming noise, which was clearly emanating from the crippled craft. It was a dull grey metallic colour, although any further details were hard to examine as there was an intense heat which radiated in all directions. So intense was the heat, in fact, that several patches of dried grass began to burn. He wasn't sure if he could see an occupant moving or not, but Lakasha had a sudden urge to inform the authorities in case there were any survivors. By the time he arrived at the police department, it was a little after 10:20 p.m. Lakasha would speak with the officer on duty that evening, Sergeant Thobo. He would state that a strange aircraft had crashed on his farm. Furthermore, there could be injured crew. And it was frightening his cattle, so he required the police to remove the metallic ruin. After several moments, Thobo, along with Constable Nandi, would follow Lakasha back to his farm to investigate. Their report would state that a large, round, disc-shaped object lay within the boundaries of Mr. Lakasha's farm. They would estimate the object was around 60 feet in length and around 10 feet high. They would confirm the colour to be dull grey, while also stating they could see no windows or portholes, nor could they see anywhere to indicate a point of entry or exit from this mysterious craft. Despite the ruinous appearance at the scene, the craft itself didn't appear to the officers to have any significant external damage. Unsure what to do, Thobo would radio into the police switchboard. He would receive orders to return to the station, prepare a report immediately, which he did. Around an hour later, shortly after midnight, an official internal report went from the police to a Lesotho government official. They would authorise the report to go to the South African Intelligence Department. It would appear a covert operation to recover the craft was already underway. According to the apparent South African military reports, they would receive correspondence from the Lesotho Ministry of Defence at 17 minutes past midnight. The location given was on the land of a cattle and livestock farmer. They would at first confirm no other military or civilian aircraft were in the area. Aside from an Air Force Puma helicopter which pursued routine aerial patrols of the South African Lesotho border, no other craft was airborne. Two rescue helicopters would receive orders to fly to the location. At a little after 1 a.m, Captain Main Lowe would report back to the base. He would state that around 400 square metres of land was engulfed in fire. However, the crashed craft, a disc-shaped metallic object, was completely undamaged and intact. He would also state, though, that his sight was hampered by the fact it was night and by the thick smoke rising from below. he would receive instructions to maintain a patrol of the immediate area. In the meantime, an effort was underway to secure the area on the ground. A sterile area of around a mile would go into effect in all directions of the crash site. At some point between 2 and 3 a.m, the South African military intelligence had taken over the response. By 3:47 a.m, the entire area would be secure and on lockdown. Soldiers on the ground received permission to use lethal force if required to maintain this security. By 5:55 a.m. on the morning of 16th of September, the Foreign Technology Recovery Unit arrived on site. The incident and what exactly happened still remains a mystery. If we turn our attention several decades earlier to the cold evening of January 23rd, 1974, near the Burin Mountains in Wales in the United Kingdom, there is an event that continues to divide opinion even today. At a little past 8:30 in the evening, the ground around the Burin Mountains shook. It sounded very much like an explosion, and the orange glow on the mountainside would suggest that that was exactly what it was. The official explanation would state that an earthquake measuring around 3.5 on the Richter scale had hit the area. The epicentre, as stated by the British Geological Survey, was likely to be Bala Lake. This was, incidentally, the same spot where local residents would report seeing the aftermath of an explosion. The explosion, according to military reports, was the result of a bizarre meteor shower. One meteor had gone crashing into the mountainside. Police switchboards would go into meltdown with reports from concerned residents. Strangely, however, the initial public report would leave out these sightings. Only years later, in 2008, did leaked documents reveal them to be true. And what's more, many of the reports to police that evening would state clearly that residents believed they had seen a UFO in the sky before the earthquake had struck. One particularly interesting note in the leaked document is one recorded by a police officer on duty that evening. It reads that there was a large explosion in the area, and there was a large fire in the mountainside, and that the officer could see the fire from where he was standing. Despite what the military was offering as the official version of events, it was obvious to anyone with an interest in the incident that their version was far from the truth. Despite the official explanation, various other reports would come from members of the public. In fact, some people got a lot closer than the military would have liked. Nurse Pat Evans, upon request of local police after hearing of her profession, would attempt to attend the site in case her skills could be of use. As she was heading towards the site in her car, she noticed strange lights going up and down the mountainside. At first, she thought these were rescue teams. However, she soon began to realise how difficult the terrain would be to negotiate. Besides, these lights appeared to move in a very strange manner. She would also state to seeing a pulsating orange glow from a stationary position on the mountain. She would further state in 2010 that the object couldn't have gotten there in any other way aside from being flown. To Evans, there is no doubt that it had to be some kind of UFO. Evans quickly realised that whatever was sat on the mountainside, it certainly wasn't the scene of an aircraft crash. Her two teenage daughters, who were in the car with her, were beginning to become uneasy and scared. Taking a last look at the bizarre scene, Evans turned around her car and headed for home. She would further elaborate 40 years later that the object was moonlike but without windows or doors, and that she had never seen anything like it before or since. One of the first experienced UFO researchers on the scene was Margaret Fry, whose house sat close to the area. It was her investigations and collecting of witness statements that would form the core of events that evening. Newspaper reports at the time made little mention of earthquakes, despite the official explanation offered to them. One of the first articles concerning the incident stated there was a huge explosion and a shaking of the ground. Fry would speak to several local residents, who would paint a far different picture than the military. One of the more interesting was a statement from a local hotel manager. She would state to Fry that in the hotel bar each evening following the incident, the conversation was increasingly about the military sealing off the area, and of ushering anyone who got too close away without explanation. There were also reports of an increased American military presence. In the hours leading up to the event, two long-haul lorry drivers were driving back from Lincolnshire to the area. Their hopes were to arrive back in time to at least catch last orders in their local pub. On their way, each would notice a strange cigar-shaped object apparently hovering over Bala Lake. They continued to watch the object as they drove. Upon arriving at the pub, however, they would find it was shut. They banged on the door, wondering why the pub had shut their doors early. Only when they looked at their watch did they realise it was after 1 a.m. In the days after the event, a family were driving along a quiet road around 20 miles from the Burin Mountains. A strange humming sound suddenly filled the air. Out of nowhere, a saucer-shaped object passed in front of them just above the treetops. It then vanished out of sight. There were many other claims concerning the crash over the coming years and decades, and you can read about them in detail in our article on the Burin Mountains incident at ufoinsight.com. Just see the link in the description. Perhaps the most intriguing of these, though, was from a whistleblower who came to have been one of the military personnel at the location that evening. He would speak to the late UFO investigator Tony Dodd and state that he was one of the drivers of the large military trucks. What's more, the cargo they were transporting was a live alien being, further claiming it was taken to the top secret facility in Porton Down in Wiltshire, England. How true those claims are, much like the claims of a crashed vehicle from another world, remain very much open to debate. There is perhaps one more thing we should consider, that the very notion of a crashed UFO could very well serve the interests of both the military and intelligence departments. It is known, for example, that many of the German rocket scientists and engineers that came to the United States as part of Operation Paperclip conducted many of the initial rocket tests in the same areas where many UFO sightings and crashes were said to have occurred. Might it be that these UFO crashes were actually the result of rocket tests and experiments that had gone disastrously wrong, perhaps even fatally? In the book Alien Contact, Jenny Randalls pointed out such experiments and the potential that the military would have to cover up the aftermath of such events. There were also, according to some sources, tests and experiments using pilots, and it has mostly been believed that these pilots were monkeys. However, as Randalls points out, a photograph claiming to show the charred remains of an alien pilot also appears to show the crippled remains of a pair of spectacles. Assuming that an alien or monkey occupant would have no need for spectacles, the only possibility that remains is that the pilot was a human being. And of course, such disclosure of this, as speculative as it might be, would be damaging beyond belief for the military. Unable to simply keep these tests secret, it was perhaps very much in their interests to have stories of crashed UFOs enter the public arena that could then be dismissed as nonsense, as opposed to the grim news of failed rocket launches that could pose a threat to the general public, not to mention how such news would be viewed on the other side of the Iron Curtain in what was the Cold War. The fact is, there are more claims and allegations of UFO crashes than even many in the UFO community might realise, and these allegations take on a more mysterious aspect when we add in the possibility that they are double bluff type cover-ups in order to hide speculative disasters of the early rocket tests. What's more, we've examined only a very small minority of such crashes that are on record. Indeed, there are so many that we will almost certainly return to this subject in a future podcast episode. We should perhaps contemplate just how many of these potential otherworldly vehicles are crashing down to the Earth. And if even only some of these reports are genuine, what happens to these crippled remains of these futuristic craft? Indeed, like all other aspects of the UFO and alien question, the possibility of crashed alien vehicles is as nuanced as it is interesting. For now, I will simply thank you for joining me once again, and be sure to leave any thoughts in the comments, and check out the links for further reading on some of the cases we have been discussing here. Remember to subscribe to our channel, and follow us on social media to keep up to date on future podcasts, articles and videos. And if there is anything you want us to feature on a future podcast episode, just get in touch at marcus@ufoinsight.com. Until next time, goodbye, and take care.